Welcome to the Power of Attorney Project, which is part of our Conversations That Matter podcast. My name is Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. This podcast is intended to provide general information only and is not intended to be a substitute for seeking personalized legal, financial, or other advice. This podcast raises issues that our audience can further explore on their own in their own local communities with their own local experts. This project will help to be a call to action for families to solve their issues, find solutions to their problems, and have greater peace of mind.
Welcome to the first episode of our Power of Attorney podcast with our guest expert, Dr. Sandra Campbell. Welcome, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you, Mary. It's good to be here.
This is an exciting project, and we're glad that you're part of it. So today's topic is, who is a substitute decision maker, or more commonly known as a POA?
Right. So would you like me to jump right in then to that comment, that question?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, power of attorney or substitute decision maker really is kind of fancy terminology for people who care about and for disabled or older adults. You know, I, as a senior, could appoint anyone really that I trusted through a lawyer. I'd have to work with a lawyer. I could appoint someone that I trusted to make decisions on my behalf. So it could be, you know, a spouse, a daughter, a son, a grandchild, niece, nephew, neighbors even, or friends. It really can be anyone that the disabled person cares about and who cares for them and who they trust. And often these decision makers are over 65 years old, and some are even over 80 years old. Such as a spouse. So it's a very special group of people.
Well, that's very interesting. And what are their challenges as a substitute decision maker?
Well, they have a lot of challenges. It's hard to know where to begin. You know, caregiving can go on for more than 10 years, and in fact, sometimes goes on much longer. Sometimes it's quite short, 6 months or so, but it varies greatly. And the age and the condition of the person providing the care of the substitute decision maker also affects the challenge. Often people are feeling quite burdened by their role. They may be providing very difficult physical care. They might be dealing with mental health issues. They might be having financial concerns, and they will have multiple family roles. You know, sometimes a spouse, for example, is caring for their husband or wife, but they're also providing support for their children, maybe even for their grandchildren. So it can be very challenging with multiple roles. And then some of the things that they're doing, you know, they may be distributing medication to the person because the other person may not be able to read the medication label or may not understand the medication. They'll maybe driving them to appointments and to clinics and to recreational activities and to shop. They may be paying some of their bills. They may be helping them get dressed. They may be toileting them. They may be bathing them. They may be accompanying them to a medical appointment to be another set of ears and eyes. They may be providing overall supervision, that is making sure the person stays safe. They may be helping to feed them or to cue them when to eat. They may be doing things like putting eye drops in or tending wounds. So there's a whole range of activities that the substitute decision makers may be taking on. On the other hand, though, it can also be someone who's simply been assigned the role of making the decisions on behalf of someone if they become incapacitated, and it may go no further than that. So there's quite a variance in the role and in the challenges. And that's only two or three categories. There are many others. For example, the person who's in this role may know nothing about disability or about aging, and they find themselves just, you know, immersed in the issues of aging and the issues of disability and ability, and it can be very, very complicated to deal with, even if you do understand and do have the knowledge of what happens when we get older. So if you don't have that knowledge and everything comes as a surprise, it's even harder. They may not know much about caregiving or about the services that are available in the community. All of these things can create big challenges. Another thing that can happen is, and this I would say is particularly in the case of a son or daughter, is where there may have been a difficult relationship in earlier times. It could be a spouse as well. If you have children who had very rocky relationships with their parent, and then they end up as a substitute decision maker for that parent or a power of attorney, it can get very complicated because some of that difficulty from an earlier time can come forward in the relationship now. Usually, and I would say almost always, the caregiver is compassionate and wants to help. But over time, it can still become very burdensome, and the person can be overwhelmed by the responsibility and by their lack of knowing what to do and how to make things better. The caregiver themselves could become sick or be hospitalized, and these things make caregiving even more difficult. And they may have their own issues to deal with. You know, they may have their own mental health issues and physical health issues. They may have developmental concerns. They may be unemployed. They may have other family issues to deal with. So you've got this substitute decision maker working with the person who needs support in a kind of an isolated environment often, and with all of these challenges hanging over them. It is a very difficult job, and there are thousands and thousands and thousands of Canadians filling this role right as we speak.
And as our population ages, there will only be more of these people, and the stresses on them and our whole society will obviously increase too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, if you think about it, these people are often, well, I would say they're often volunteering their time. But even more than that, sometimes people give up their jobs to provide this kind of support. And so they are providing a tremendous support to our society. If you just imagine what it might be like if we had volunteer substitute decision makers and POAs, what would we do? How would we help all these folks? It would be a pretty pricey situation.
Pricey and virtually impossible would be my guess.
Exactly, exactly. There really are thousands and thousands of caregivers. I'd have to go back to my records to find out the numbers, but I mean, it's escalating with the aging population every year, and the aging population is not going to peak for another few years. So, yeah, we've got a tiger by the tail with this one.
Absolutely. And some of the most current statistics say that one in four Canadians is a caregiver, a family caregiver. And within that, there are a great number who are the actual substitute decision makers. Absolutely.
That's right.
And even within families, if you're not the substitute decision maker, you might be the sibling of the SDM, then you are still concerned with what goes on and still have a role to help as best possible, I hope. So it's an issue that everyone within a family has to deal with.
Yes, and ideally you would deal with it as a team. And there are professionals around who can help you with that, can help you to plan who's going to do what, who's going to pay for what, who's going to drive mom to the doctor, who's going to buy the next, mobility aid or whatever it is that's needed. And so the family can really be a fabulous support for the senior who really needs this kind of help, senior or disabled person, or both. And families sometimes just don't know what to do and don't know where to turn or how to figure out how to work together. But there are professionals around who can help with that.
And that's so important for our audience to know, because clearly not all families will get along and there will be challenges amongst the adult children. So knowing that there are people and services to help them through this will help give them guidance and add some structure to what actually has to get done. So thank you for adding that families can reach out to professionals to help walk them through this journey. No family member usually is trained for this job, but there's a lot of smart experts out there that can help and guide a family.
That's right.
And I know when I was my parent substitute decision maker, my siblings and I, we got along very well. But it would have been nice if we had known more services out in the community. Many days I thought I was just winging it, and every day was a new challenge and a new opportunity. So reaching out to the social services community, I think, is key for families to not only survive this journey, but to embrace it.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So when we think about these people, what should we not assume about them?
Well, there used to be an idea in the literature that said that most people who are engaged in elder abuse are burned out caregivers. This is so far from the truth. This is not true. So don't assume, you've got to start with the assumption that people are compassionate and people care about their family. And I'm here to say that almost without exception, the families that I have met are very committed to their older person. And you may hear lots of criticism, but really most of it's undeserved. So don't assume that they're abusive in any way at all. Start with the positive. Don't assume that they know about aging, though, or about services. They may have quite a lack of knowledge. What they're trying to do is help their parent, help their sibling, help their spouse. And don't assume that they can handle it all the time. It just gets overwhelming, as you just spoke to. It's very difficult. It's one of the hardest roles in life, I think. Probably, I would say, just as hard as parenting, really. And it's not the same, not the same at all, but just as difficult.
Absolutely. And so what do substitute decision makers think about? What's important to them, Dr. Campbell?
Well, I think the first thing is that they're worried about their loved one. They're worried about how much help they will get, how much help will be available if things deteriorate. They're worried about what will happen if the person is forced to consider institutionalization. And they are worried about institutionalization. There have been studies done, and almost without exception, older people do not want to go into an institution, and their families don't want them to need to go into an institution, yet it gets to be absolutely essential in some cases. But there is a lot of worry around institutionalization. And for the older person themselves, they're frightened of institutional care because they've heard horror stories and they've watched family members and friends, and they don't understand. But truthfully, there's just not enough money in the long-term care system or in the home care system to allow older people to live with dignity with doable help from their friends and family. So we've got a situation that is very difficult for people. And I think that those who are younger, people who are probably younger than, I don't know, 75 maybe, don't really fully get it until you're faced with the reality of considering institutionalization for yourself or for your loved one. You don't, and only some people understand when they're dealing with their loved one, they don't really understand what's really happening. And there's a lot of fear around that in both the older person, the disabled person, and in the substitute decision maker.
Can you share with us a real-life example of someone who is a substitute decision maker and what they're going through?
Yeah, I can. I've worked with a lot of people who are substitute decision makers and the people they're caring for. And let me say before I give you this example, it's only one example. There are many, many kinds of situations. They're all very unique and very individualized. And, of course, it depends on the level of disability that the person who is disabled is living with. And it depends on the skills and personality and all kinds of things of the care provider, of the substitute decision maker. So an example would be an older woman who's over 80 and caring for a disabled husband who is, I don't know, let's say 85. And by the way, I do change these stories so that you couldn't identify who it was because I am bound by confidentiality. So this person is caring for someone who's disabled with early stage dementia. But the older woman herself is on her own oxygen, and she helps him on and off the toilet because he's got mobility issues and is unable to get on and off the toilet by himself. She helps him get dressed. She prompts him to feed himself. She takes him to a special clinic for care, and she tries to persuade him to do some things for himself, tries to help him do some things for her, for himself. And I don't know whether you can picture what that would be like on a day-to-day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week schedule. You know, the first week, the first month, maybe even the first year, you can get through. But after a while, it starts to wear you down. She doesn't get a break. She gets frustrated. And, you know, it gets so that even getting out to go and get the groceries can be difficult. And, you know, he doesn't always agree with her ideas about care, and she doesn't always agree with him. And as in a typical marriage, there might be some disagreements. And then there's the cost of private clinics and private services. And you can bump up the care by paying yourself for some individualized care. And that is a wonderful thing for a caregiver to be able to access because there's a limited number of hours available from the government services. But the caregiver can be fairly costly in that regard, but it is available, and I certainly encourage people to use that kind of service. And then, of course, there's this debate that goes on about institutional care. You know, is it a good idea? Is it not? Which option will we go for? How would we make it happen? And just on that front, I would just really advise people to try to talk about it. Even persons who have early stage dementia, they have lots of times when they have good brain function and they're able to discuss in a rational way. Talk about it. And what else? Can I tell you about this family? The children of this couple, they have two children, and the children aren't always in agreement. You know, one child is more worried about the older woman, and the other child is more worried about the older man. And so they get into some conflicts sometimes. So this is kind of a typical story in a way. of what it looks like. Do you have any questions?
No, and that's a great example because you often look at families and you go, who's really helping here? And how hard it is to be the caregiver, especially as you said, for years and years. And I really think family caregivers and people who are substitute decision makers are absolute unsung heroes in our society.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so my final question for you is, what do they need?
What do they need? Well, I'm just going to refer to something here and okay. So, you know, I've talked about caregiver issues, but I don't know what I've talked about in this. I'm just going to summarize them, if that's okay, before I talk about the needs. So the issues are, first of all, they can't get enough respite care. That is, they can't get a break. They can't get someone to come in when they need somebody to come in to be there when they have to go out. And if it gets to that point, you know, if the older or the disabled person needs round-the-clock supervision or companionship, it gets so you really need to go to the grocery store, to go and get your hair cut, to go to your own doctor appointment. And so respite care is very important. Secondly, it's stress overload, as I've already mentioned. Thirdly, it's trying to be able to get out and talk with other people to look after yourself. Fourth is the physical difficulty of the work. You know, we may have an 80-year-old woman who's trying to lift her husband on and off the toilet. Very difficult. They may need training as to how to do it. And it's emotionally exhausting. And I say that with an exclamation point. Absolutely exhausting. So the needs are that, you know, they need information about aging and caregiving and services. They need physical help with the work. And that might come from families or neighbors or a paid provider. They need relief. That is, they need respite to get a break. They need emotional support. They need to have people give them credit for doing a good job. You know, it's kind of a lonely job because you're in the home with the person most of the time. Nobody sees what you're doing. Often you may feel that nobody cares. But if you see this situation, you can really make the situation better if you support the person and tell them that they're doing a fabulous job. If you think they are, of course, you wouldn't want to say that if you didn't think that. And finally, they need help and support from other members of the family. So there are other needs, but I think these are the ones that I would target as the most important. And there are providers around that can offer this kind of thing, and many of us can help our friends and neighbors with some of these things. You know, we could go over and rake some leaves, or we could offer to stay with the disabled person while the care provider goes out, etc. There's a lot of things we can do. Tell them what a great job they're doing.
Those are all really good points, and I'm sure people listening into this will say, you know what, could we do to help these caregivers and these substitute decision makers stick with their job and do a good job and just help them as best we can. And I think our society recognizes the value of family caregivers, but I think we can all do a better job to help them out. And these substitute decision makers not only have the care issues, but many of them have the financial responsibilities of managing their money and their their legal affairs.
Absolutely.
So it's almost like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that they're all trying to figure out how to make this puzzle come together. Dr. Campbell, I would like to thank you for joining us on this episode, and perhaps people would like to be in touch with you. Do you have contact information to share?
I do. And first, let me say that I've enjoyed being part of this as well. Caregivers and older people are my passion, and it's a joy to be able to try to help a bit as I can. So my contact information is, it's an email, it's sandra@commonpoint.ca. And Common Point is all one word, commonpoint.ca.
Wonderful. Thank you, and goodbye, Dr. Campbell.
Goodbye.
Mary, who are our initial project supporters?
We wish to acknowledge that this project is funded in part by the Government of Canada's New Horizons for Seniors program. Our other initial supporters include Care Connect, the Care Guide, the Healing Cycle Foundation, and Scotia Trust. Caregiving Matters is an internet-based registered Canadian charity dedicated to educating and supporting family caregivers. 90% of our work is done online and by leveraging technologies. 10% is done by producing local educational events. We leverage technologies in everything that we do, ensuring greater reach and sustainability. I trust that we have given you some of the highlights of our exciting new initiative. If you are interested in speaking with me about the project, please let me know. We look forward to your questions and your ideas.
Mary, if listeners have questions, what's the best way for them to contact us?
Well, they can contact me, Mary Bart, Chair of Caregiving Matters. My email is mary@caregivingmatters.ca. Our telephone number is 905-939-2931, and our website is www.caregivingmatters.ca.